27. The Shape of the Enthusiast. Climbing the stairs, she reflects on how she feels no interest now in doing the Bond thing. No spit-secured hair waiting to be checked. Less a matter of faith in the German locks than a sort of fatalism. Anyone able to get into Catherine McNally's Fifth Avenue office and steal or copy her notes on Casey's sessions will be able to get past those locks, she seems to have decided. But could that really have happened? Had some figure entered in the dead of night and crept past the low table in the small reception area, with its three-year-old copies of Time and Cosmopolitan? She unlocks the door, twice, opens it, seeing she's forgotten to leave a light on. "Fuck you!" she calls to anyone who might be waiting. Turning on the light, locking the door behind her, she has a look upstairs. Case Pollard Central Standard, indicating that sleep is not yet worth attempting. She powers up Damien's G4, opens Netscape, and goes to FFF, watching the keystrokes required to get there. If Dorothea is telling the truth, her Asian sluts boy had installed software on this machine that records the user's every keystroke. The recorded sequences can be retrieved from elsewhere via some sort of back door. Does it give them mouse clicks as well? She wonders. But how would they know what you were clicking on? Perhaps all they see is keystrokes, or keystrokes and URLs. FFF is starting to look unfamiliar after her relatively long absence. She doesn't recognise most of the handles of the posters on the current page. She remembers something about a recent television special having generated a wave of newbies. Are these unfamiliar names then? She scans a few threads without opening any posts, judging them by titles alone. Segment 135 is still a hot topic, as is the Brazilian satanic footage thing. She sits back and stares at the screen, hands in her lap. The keyboard spooks her now, and imagines more shadowy figures in another room, a sort of man from Uncle room, seated, staring at a huge screen on which there is nothing but this page of FFF, waiting for Case to open a post. She lets them wait, then closes Netscape and powers down. She no longer has to devote any thought to cabling the iBook to the cell phone. If Boone was right, back in Tokyo, this one isn't passing any keystrokes to the man from Uncle Room. Although, she thinks, entering Hotmail, what if they came round while she was out for Greek food and... Fuck it, aloud, to Damien's robot girls. She can't live that way. Refuses. Hotmail has three for her. The first is from Boone. Hi, greetings from LGA, the land of very intense security. Out of here shortly for Columbus and initial meeting with the firm in question. We'll have to play that completely by ear, of course. How are you? Let me know. You are not, she thinks, the most eloquent of correspondents. But what, she asks herself, is she expecting? Shakespeare from a layover at LaGuardia? Hi yourself. On my laptop, as per our discussion. Okay here. Nothing to report. Puckerboy next, opening on Jesus. My mother was very religious in her dysfunctional way. Have I told you that? Hence all my fear words are blasphemous, I suppose. Daryl is letting Judy script the Keiko mail. As you said, we had no choice other than to do. She's virtually moved in with him now, and has phoned in sick two nights running. She's mesmerized by the extent, she says, the heartbreaking purity of Tacky's passion for her. This in spite of the fact that she knows Tacky thinks she's a petite Japanese college girl, and that Daryl is translating for her both ways. Actually, he indicates to me he's trying as much as possible to tone Judy's script down, and has told her that he doesn't really have that thorough a command of Japanese sexual vernacular. Not true. Says she's starting to cry a lot, and to say that the love tack he has to offer her is the love she's waited for all her life. This is, frankly, some of the weirdest shit to wash up my alley in a while, and I suppose it would be darkly funny if only we weren't trying to... BTW, what are we trying to do here? By insisting we let Judy do this, we've lost our fulcrum for extracting more mystic material. Aside from which, we could lose Tacky altogether. Terminal priapism. Yours, PB. Next up, Ivy, FFF's founder and owner, whom she hasn't heard from since she left New York.
Hello, Case. Long time no see on the forum. Are you in Japan? I'm still here in Seoul, in big numbered building.
Ivy had once sent Case a JPEG of her high-rise, with a 10-story 4 painted up the side. Behind it, receding into the distance, you could make out buildings 5 and 6, identical.
Mama Anakia does not write to me often. That is fine with me. You know she has always gotten on my nerves.
Ivy and Case have sometimes had to coordinate diplomacy to prevent the friction between Parker Boy and La Anakia from polarizing the site, or simply taking up too much space. She freezes.
Are you in Japan?
Unless Parker Boy has told Ivy about Case's trip, which Case cannot imagine him doing under the circumstances, something is very wrong here.
Today I had a very strange email from her, very friendly, thanking me for FFF, etc., then asking about you, like she is your old friend. From this I think you are in Tokyo, but something about this makes me worry. Here is the only part of her message referring to you. I can send the rest if you want. And how is Case P?
She is not posting recently.
You know, of course, that I was an avid lurker before I began to post, and Case P's insight struck me, the first post of hers I read, as the very shape of the enthusiast. That was the one in which she suggested that the maker had the resources of the Russian mafia, or some similarly secretive organization. Do you remember it? One day I hope to meet her in person, perhaps when she returns from Tokyo.
Case scowls at the screen. Feels like hurling it at the nearest robot girl.
No fair! No fucking fair! She doesn't need this!
But if Mama Anakia is somehow involved in the recent weirdness, why would she tip her hand this way to Ivy? To send a message to Case? Or... because Mama made a mistake. Freudian slip, meant to type London, not Tokyo. The restraint of pen and tongue that Wynne always advised is difficult to maintain in a medium that involves neither, Case knows. And mistakes happen. She and Mama Anakia are not friends, by any means. At best, they have exchanged a few strained messages. Case is too obviously Parker Boy's friend on the site, and Parker Boy's loathing for Mama Anakia has been far too vocal, from his scathing assaults on the French philosophers she quotes, to deliberately absurd personal attacks, considering he's never met her and has no idea of what she might look like. This email to Ivy is a fishing expedition of some kind, and a clumsy one. Although Mama Anakia has no way, that Case knows of, to know that she and Ivy are friends, and discuss the site and its more prominent participants in private, and fairly frequently.
Creepy. She takes a deep breath. He took a duck in the face at 250 knots.
Reflexively, like a slot player pulling the lever, in hope of bringing down a better reality, She clicks Hotmail, in case another message has arrived in the meantime. Margot, her Australian friend in New York, former Big End girlfriend, currently assigned to visit Casey's apartment on a frequent basis, pick up mail, check that all is well. Margot lives two blocks closer to Harlem proper, but still within the psychological footprint of Columbia.
Hello, dear. Bit of worry here.
Went to your place today, as usual. Saw your super sweeping steps, and he wasn't visibly pissed. But that isn't the unusual I have to report. Actually, I wish I could be more certain about this, but I think someone else had been in your flat since I was last there. Two things. The toilet was running when I went in. I'd used it last time I was there, and it kept running, so I took the lid off the cistern and jiggled the bit that stops it running, and it did. Running again this time when I came in, but I didn't notice that at first. Everything fine? Neat as a pin? How do you do that? Then I noticed the toilet running again. Gave me a shiver. But of course, your plumbing was old when the Boer War was news, so it might just start, the way plumbing does sometimes. But it spooked me a bit. Then I'm walking around looking at everything, and of course I can't remember exactly how everything was, but you've got so little in there, and it's so tidy, and really it all looked the same. But it was a sunny day. Lovely, really. Sun coming in through your white drapes in the living room, open just a bit. And I was trying to remember how I placed the mail day before yesterday. When I put it down beside your computer, you hadn't had any today. And in that sunlight, I could see how dusty things were getting, and thinking I'd be a pal and dust for you. And then I saw that I could just make out a rectangle in the dust where your mail had been when I put it there last time. Your mail was just to the side now. I could see that a bit more dust had settled there since. Am I the only one with the keys? Your drunken super come to fix the toilet? Let me know, and if you think I should do anything about it. Are you coming back soon? I thought it was only a short one. Have you seen the world's biggest shit? No. Don't tell me. Margot. Case closes her eyes and sees her blue-floored cave, her $1,200 a month rent-stabilised apartment on 111th, secured when her former roommate, the previous leaseholder, had moved back to San Francisco. Home. Who's been there? Not the super. Not without a bribe. How she hates this. How faint and peripheral somehow, these little things. Yet how serious. A weight on her life, like trying to sleep under Damien's silver oven mitt. And suddenly, she's dead tired. As if Case Pollard's standard time had clicked forward 5 hours. Trembling with it, though at the same time she doesn't trust that she'll be able to sleep. Shuts down the iBook, disconnects the cell phone, checks the locks. Looks in the bathroom for more melatonin, but of course that's gone to Russia. She feels like crying, though for no particular reason. Just this invasive weirdness that seems increasingly a part of her world, and she doesn't know why. She turns off lights, undresses, crawls into bed, grateful for her own foresight in having removed and put away the oven mitt earlier in the day. And has utterly no memory, subsequently, of any transition to West Broadway, where she stands in the middle of empty, white-coated pavement, a thin inch of fresh snow, in some deep, and deeply silent hour of the night, the hour of waking alone. And she is alone. Neither pedestrians nor traffic,
and no light in any window, nor streetlights. And yet she can see, as though the snow of this frozen zone is sufficient illumination. Neither footprints nor tire tracks mar it. And as she turns to look behind, she sees no footprints there either, not even her own. To her right, the brick face of the Soho Grand. To her left, a bistro where she remembers taking Donnie once. And then, down at the corner, middle distance, she sees him. The black coat that may or may not be leather, its collar turned up. The body language she knows from uncounted viewings of 135 segments of footage. And she wants to call out, but something in her chest prevents her. And she struggles to take a first step, and then another, imprinting the virgin snow. And then she is running, the unzipped Rixons flapping beneath her arms like wings. But as she runs toward him, he seems always to recede. And with the awareness of this, she is in Chinatown, white streets equally deserted, and she has lost him, beside a grocery, shuttered, gasping. She looks up then, and sees, Borealis faint, but sharp-edged and tall as heaven, twin towers of light. As her head goes back to find their tops, a vertigo seizes her. They narrow up into nothing at all, a vanishing point, like railway tracks up into the desert of sky. "Ask him," her father says. And she turns to find him, dressed as she's imagined him to have dressed on that morning. His good overcoat open over his business suit, right hand extended. And in it, the black cylinder of a Kurter calculator. "The dead can't help you, and the boy's no good." Grey eyes framed with thin wires of gold become the colour of that sky. "Father." And managing to speak, wakes, awash with grief and terror, and some sense of a decision made, though she knows not what, nor yet by whom, nor if indeed she ever will. She has to turn on the light, to be sure that this is Damien's. She wishes Damien were here. She wishes anyone were here.